And welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us here as we get set for another hour of interesting conversation with our guest and the conversation around the book that has been written. I want to remind you that we come your way every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time, and you're also able to hear us live on the internet at richarddugan.com. Somebody apparently associated with Facebook, which I really don't do. I mean, yes, okay, I have a Facebook page, but I don't check it regularly, and I just happened to look the other day, and somebody had done what they call a tag. They had tagged me in a photo, and I thought, well, what photo could they have tagged me in? And the photo was posted on their wall. Well, the photo is a picture of me from my webpage. Of course I'm going to be tagged from my own photo. I put it up there. I just thought that was really very interesting. But the comment, which I still haven't been able to get a clear definition of, was three letters. W-A-W-O-W. Wow. What the heck does that mean? So, you know, you can post, you do whatever you want. That's fine. It's not intriguing to me at this particular point. One day it might be, but tag, you're it, I guess, is the way the phrase goes. Today's program, I think, is going to be a lot of fun for us. I had a lot of fun actually putting the promo together because I had to search out the theme music. Not so much to the book, but at least to the story behind the book. And that was The Wizard of Oz. And we are sort of off to see the wizard. We joke around here at the radio station, do not look behind, ignore the man behind the curtain. Usually they're referring to me. Return to the Land of Oz. The gentleman you're hearing chuckling there in the background is John Tamiazzo. You are a PhD, a doctor of?
Psychology.
Psychology. Now I'm scared. I'm afraid I'll be psychoanalyzed before the end of the show.
It's transpersonal psychology.
As opposed to what?
What is transpersonal? Well, as opposed to a strict clinical approach. Transpersonal is more of a spiritual dimension of psychology that explores altered states of consciousness, which include meditation states, hypnosis states, dream states, drug states.
I knew there was a reason I was going to have you on the program. And to me, that's all very fascinating stuff.
Yeah,
so intriguing.
It combines East-West, what's called consciousness psychology. And I was fortunate enough to have as three of my teachers at college, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, Raymond Moody, and Brian Weiss, who all became superstars.
Wow. Wow. Two out of the three, the names are familiar.
Which one isn't?
The last one.
Brian Weiss?
Brian Weiss.
He wrote a book called, I forgot the name of the book, but he specializes in, Many Lives, Many Masters.
Oh, yes, now their name does ring a bell.
Yeah,
I've read that book, yes.
Yeah, and he's been giving workshops on that book and presentations on that book for probably 20 years.
I took psychology in college for a semester. I think I got a C in it. But I took it not so that I could get an A or B or anything, but because I was so interested in those realms of the mind and the psyche.
Yes.
Which I think more translates more into the spirit, if you will, or the soul of the person.
Exactly.
And getting those different dynamics, whether it was, Jungian psychology or Freudian, which we don't need to go into. But you've written a book called Returning. ING. We're going back to the Land of Oz. Basically, we are going to finding hope, love, and courage on your yellow brick road. We're going to talk more about some of the metaphors and the overall metaphor, but what's interesting is you're not doing this from the standpoint of the movie, because the movie was made from the book.
Yes.
And the movie didn't exactly follow the book. It kind of left some things out.
Some important pieces, yes.
Yeah, and I wonder why that was. Maybe we can talk a little bit about that as we continue.
Sure.
First of all, you used to live here in Santa Barbara.
20 years.
20 years.
Yeah.
And you taught for City College?
I still do. I teach for the adult education. I've been teaching there for 25 years.
Wow. And so you I would take it you have a class that's ongoing now during the fall semester.
Well, now since I've moved north a bit, I do these Saturday workshops, all-day workshops. I have one coming up on the 30th, the day before Halloween.
Ooh.
And my classes now are courses on imagery. People come with all kinds of disorders, problems with sleep, problems with weight, problems with pain, problems with focus, wanting to know what to do next with their life. And so what we do is I help them to use their own imagination and their own ability to see their future in a different way, so they don't look at their future in a negative way. They start thinking of it more positively, because the point of the whole class is to help alter your brain chemistry in a way that will support you and what you want to do.
New paradigms for a new world.
Exactly.
That's where we're headed. All right. Well, John, it's great to have you here in the program. Again, the book is called Returning to the Land of Oz.
Yes.
And we encourage you to stay tuned. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, and we will be right back.
Remember the stories your family used to tell?
July got married, 1913, when my father and my uncle came from Italy.
When was the last time you listened to the songs of your youth?
Very swinging sound here in the Bilhart Underground. That's Wild Things.
Want to hear those voices and music again? Fast Forward can help. Fast Forward Audio Communications can transfer your records and tapes to CD so you can hear them again for the first time.
Okay, standby. They want to get you a mail hold right now until they go, and they'll go. Standby.
You're listening to a live transmission of the voice of astronaut Walter Chirac.
Those memories are priceless and are great to hand down to the next generation. Keep those memories alive. Call 805-708-9804.
That's the greatest thing that I ever heard.
Fast Forward. It's the right direction for preserving your family memories. Just call 805-708-9804.
Tucked away at 7 East Anapamu, behind Sullivan Goss and American Gallery, just across the street from the Art Museum, the delightful Arts and Letters Cafe, Santa Barbara's most romantic restaurant, is now serving dinner in addition to its famous lunch menu. That's right. Now you can enjoy a la carte service and a full bar for dinner Wednesdays through Sundays in the secluded and enchanting privacy of the garden courtyard at the Arts and Letters Cafe, where Chef Cosmo Goss prepares fine California cuisine with an emphasis on fresh local seafood. Or for diners who want to enjoy the street scene in Santa Barbara's historic arts district, the Arts and Letters Cafe offers front porch dining with happy hour bar service and light fare. That's the Arts and Letters Cafe at 7 East Anapamu, where great food and great art combine for a wonderful dining experience for lunch and dinner.
I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, and we are here with John, and he is a PhD, John Tamiazzo, and he's written a book called Returning to the Land of Oz. Did I get the last name right, Tamiazzo?
Excellent.
It's
a difficult
one. I have to tell you that is, among all of the other pet peeves that I have, that I direct to myself, if one does not learn how to pronounce another's name, it does not show the proper respect for that person. That's why I have a little bit of angst over Ellis Island and the immigrants who came over and how their names were changed because it was easier and so disrespectful. You have that name. You may have just been given that name, but it is your name. And so when people mispronounce my name, the mispronunciation's okay. I will correct them and say, hey, no problem, because you've probably never seen it before, spelled or what have you, and that's okay. But I think that it's really important that we, because to me, that's the height of communication is being that way.
Yeah, Tamiazzo is not an easy one for people to pronounce. It's always been a challenge when I was in elementary school, high school. Even the teachers would massacre it.
Yeah.
So I remember I was a little boy coming home and saying, why do I have such a difficult name to pronounce? And my mother used to say, John, it's a musical name.
Ah.
It's a very musical name.
Interesting. Well, speaking of music, we're off to see the Wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz. You notice I didn't put any notes with that, any melody. Nonetheless, you've written a wonderful little book that is helping people to find hope, love, and courage on their yellow brick road. Why, first of all, why the Wizard of Oz?
I think it's the great American fairy tale. It's L. Frank Baum was born just 8 days after Sigmund Freud, 1856, and I found that fascinating, that these two men, only born 8 days apart, ended up in the 1890s, both writing a psychologically oriented book. Freud's writing about the interpretation of dreams and free association, and L. Frank Baum is writing The Wizard of Oz, although I think The Wizard of Oz is a lot more helpful to people than a lot of the things that Freud wrote about.
Well, Freud was, I think, I'm not that familiar with him, but, you know, a cursory understanding, it was pretty straightforward. You probably could put it all together very simply.
Actually, I think he's rather complex.
Was he complex?
Yeah,
okay.
I think so.
Well, I always thought that everything associated with sex.
Well,
I mean,
yeah, the other thing that always, I like a lot of the things that Freud did. I think he was a real pioneer, and his defense mechanisms I still think hold up today. And he did bring dreams to our awareness. The thing about him that always bothered me, though, is his relationship with women. Whereas Baum, L. Frank Baum, the creator of The Wizard of Oz, had a fabulous relationship with women and marched to help for women's rights with his mother-in-law and with his wife. And he wrote extensively about the need for women's right to vote in the 1890s in the journals that he wrote for in Chicago. Mm. So he was a fighter for the rights of women, and he had four sons. And I think Dorothy was probably the daughter he always wanted. I found it fascinating that he picked a girl, a little girl, to be the protagonist of his story.
Well, I think we could probably guess that the lion, the scarecrow, and the tin man are aspects of our own personal makeup, if you will, the courage, the brain, and the heart. And even the wizard would be under the same category of, you know, intellect and or creativity, that aspect.
And the witches.
And then there are the witches who could be the dichotomies of the female aspect of, again, of all of us.
Sure.
But you have shared, as we probably know fairly well, that any time a movie is made from a book, the movie doesn't necessarily always follow the same path as the book. And I'm kind of disappointed in that for a couple of reasons. One in particular, because if I don't have the time, haven't had an opportunity, pardon me, to read the book, I'd like to be able to see a visual representation of it from an accurate standpoint. You go to a Shakespearean play, odds are it's going to be true to Shakespeare.
Yeah,
they're not going to deviate. But when you talk about The Wizard of Oz, you mentioned one scene in particular that doesn't exist in the movie, but it is in the book, about them following the yellow brick road and coming to a chasm. They can see the other side of the chasm and that the yellow brick road continues.
Yes.
And they're on one side and it's on the other. Can you share with us that particular aspect of that part of the book and what it's telling us?
Yeah, they come to that great divide, as Baum described it, and the scarecrow looks across, looks down, and says, "We can't get over this, and we can't get down. It's too deep. If we can't figure out a way, our journey has come to an end." And so the lion starts moving back, stepping back, and calculating in his mind, and he just says, "I think I can jump over it." And so then the scarecrow says, "Well, if you can do that and take one of us on your back, one at a time, then we can all get over to the other side." And so first Dorothy goes, and then one at a time, they all go over to the other side. And he's really exhausted, the lion, because each marvelous leap gets them closer to their goal of getting to the Emerald City. So it just, why I like that particular story, and for a variety of reasons, maybe it was left out of the book or out of the film, because maybe they didn't know how to...
The logistics of creating that visually.
Yeah. But it really was the I think, pivotal scene on how they came together as a group, figured out how to get over to the other side, and by virtue of that, all of them gain the qualities, or they start realizing the qualities that they think they want, but they already have.
They already have it. They're so aware of it.
Yeah. And it also is a great scene because it really is the beginning of them working together. And the message, I think, of that is we're never alone, really. We have lots of resources available to us. And if we work together with other people, we can get a lot accomplished.
You know, I wish we could get that message across to the rest of the world, because that's why we're all here. I have told this very brief analogy many times, that if the universal power, God, the creator, whatever name you want to give to it, had intended for each one of us, 7 billion people, to live solitary lives on a planet of our own, I would venture that in the vastness of the universe, there are certainly sufficient planets to do just that. But the reality is, guess what? We're all here. And that says to me, we're all here for what you've just said, to work together.
Yeah, and that's, I think, one of the most marvelous qualities of the book, Baum's book, is that they're working together to get through all the challenges that they come upon. Two other things about what wasn't portrayed in the film that was written in the book is that in the beginning scene, Dorothy is swept up in this cyclone.
Yes.
In the film, a window becomes unhinged, hits her on the head, and she's knocked unconscious.
Right, I remember that.
In the book, that scene was written very differently. She is swept up in the cyclone. She's afraid. But then a wiser part of her comes forth and just says that everything is going to be okay. She just needs to trust. And so she closes her eyes and goes into a meditative state and becomes quiet and trusts that everything is going to be okay, and it was.
By the way, I did some searching on the internet, on YouTube, and I not only I found it's not exactly that scene, but it's not the scene where she gets hit in the head.
Uh-huh.
It's a much longer cyclonic scene of almost like 3 minutes that was not in the movie. And I thought, well, okay, yeah, it is kind of dragging on a little bit. It's not keeping my attention. I want to click somewhere else. But that was a scene that was really long, and you could see the tornado moving closer and closer to the house, and they're all running around and getting down into the cellar, and she's pounding with her foot on the cellar door, and they're not going to open it, and so she goes into the house. And I'm guessing it's only because it was so long. But that's interesting. I guess that people would not have back. And by the way, when was the movie released?
1939.
Most people back then probably would not have made the connection. What is she doing? Why is she sitting? There's a tornado coming, and she's going to sit down and what? Pray?
Well,
not many people knew about meditation back then.
Yeah. Well, there was a big movement back then. Paramahansa Yogananda was very active in Los Angeles, and he had thousands of people coming to see him, and he was teaching meditation. Then you had the Theosophists, who were very much involved in meditation back then in the 20s, 30s.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite active in
America. It was, okay.
Yes, big movements about towards meditation back then. And then I think the most important scene that was left out said a lot about Hollywood back in 1939, and that is the scene when the witch sets the scarecrow on fire.
Oh, yeah.
And Dorothy picks up the bucket of water, throws it on him, but most of the water inadvertently is thrown on the witch.
The witch.
And she begins to melt and die. Well, the way that scene was written by Baum is that they're in the castle. Dorothy is a prisoner of the witch, and the witch steals one of her shoes, and she wants the other shoe because she knows she'll be the most powerful witch in all of Oz if she has both shoes. Well, Dorothy becomes furious when she takes her shoe away and says, I want my shoe back. And she says, well, you can't have it, and I'm going to steal your other one. And in that moment, Dorothy grabs the water and throws it directly on the witch. So there's a direct confrontation, and because of that courage she had and that instinct, she wins her freedom. And then the piece that's really important is that she then goes out, Dorothy, and she saves the lion, the Tin Woodman, and the Scarecrow. They don't come and save her. Mm-hmm. There was some problem they had in the 30s with powerful women.
A little too soon. She was a woman ahead of her time as far as the book is concerned, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And that's very interesting because I remember in the movie, in that scene, she is just so apologetic to the witch who is melting. I'm so sorry. I'm sorry. I, you know, it's like she didn't mean to do it, you know, because in essence, she just killed the witch.
Yes. And she also killed the other witch with her house landing on her.
Yeah. It's not a good day for witches in that movie, I'll tell you. Why did you choose The Wizard of Oz?
Well, I thought it. I didn't. That wasn't my starting book to use. I had other ones in mind, but that one lent itself, I think, to the four themes that I think are most important in life: service to humanity, opening your heart to love, using your brain wisely, and drawing upon your inner courage and resourcefulness.
Mm. Well, it certainly has all of those.
Yeah.
So where do the Munchkins come in?
The Munchkins were really more of a Hollywood creation, because in the book, the Munchkins maybe take up a half page, or in the story, it goes on and on.
Oh, yeah,
with
they're all over the place.
Yeah, it really was not
and the Flying Monkeys.
Right.
And
no, the Flying Monkeys are in the book.
Okay. As a man of your profession, would you then take a look at each one of these different characters in the book and you'd be able to say, okay, this represents and this represents and this represents that part of our psyche?
You can. I was following along with Baum's intention, which was that this little girl actually went on this journey to Oz. It wasn't a dream.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a fabrication of her imagination. She actually went there. He wrote it so children would know that they can deal with adversity anytime in life. And if they get lost, they can find their way back home.
I'm curious as to how many people have gone back and read The Wizard of Oz. Not seen the movie.
Yeah.
But actually gone back and read it. And I will be the first one to admit, I don't recall having read the book, period. So obviously some of my questions are coming from that place of,
sure.
Oh yeah, the Munchkins, they're throughout the book, right?
Oh no. Yeah. Well, the film has been viewed by 2 billion people, and that doesn't include the DVDs and seeing at home and seeing it on television. So it is the most viewed family film in history.
Wow.
So people are really drawn to the archetypes.
Wow.
Yeah, people are drawn to the archetypes. And then in terms of the book, it was released in 1900. It won Best Children's Book in 1900, and then it won Best Children's Book in 1901 also. And then Baum wrote, I think, 12 or 13 sequels to it. He took The Wizard of Oz on the road. It was a play, a stage play for about 8 to 10 years, very successful. He made a fortune with that. He didn't make money from anything else. He tried so many different things. He tried being a chicken farmer. He was a journalist. He was selling china. He was writing a number of different books. And it was The Wizard of Oz that really put him on the map.
Oh, the message Baum needs to get is go with what works. Just stick with what works, okay? Don't franchise out in other directions.
And wonderful thing about him, too, is he had a marvelous, loving, romantic relationship with his wife the whole time they were married.
Wow. Wow.
So so that piece about opening your heart with a Tin Woodman and that love is the most important thing we can experience in life. And he was the happiest as when he was in love. This was a Tin Woodman's message. Also, I think he wrote about the Tin Woodman is because when he was a little boy, it was discovered he had a heart defect. And the reason I think the scarecrow became part of the book is because he had a repeating nightmare that he was chased by a scarecrow.
So why not give the scarecrow the need for a heart?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And P.T. Barnum was his... the one he used as a model for the Wizard of Oz.
Wow. Extraordinary when you start getting into the depths of the author's perspective, which is, of course, the reason why we have folks on, such as yourself, to talk about your work and get a little insight into who you are, where you're coming from, where you're going to. As we continue here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, I'm Richard Dugan, and we are now going to pause for just a moment and talk with our astrological or astronomical. Assignment editor Beth McDonald, and she is here to share with us some information about what in the world is going on these days. We just came out of what seemed like a never-ending phase of Mercury in retrograde. We came out of that in mid to late September. But things are still not quite on an even keel yet, and yet we're also heading into some pretty neat holidays for a wide variety of us, those of us of faith. Beth?
Well, thank you, Richard. Thanks for giving me another assignment, and thank you, John. It's so good to hear your voice again.
I know you, don't I?
You do.
We've met before.
Yes, we have. We've worked together before, and you were one of those people in the right place with the right words at the right time early in my career, and I'm just really grateful for who you are in the world and what you do. And
well, aren't you sweet?
Well,
it's a small planet. It's a small planet.
It's a small planet, you know, and you just keep doing the right thing, and it all works out.
Absolutely. So tell us what's going on from the point of view of, say, the stars, or for that matter, from our own psyches, in terms of what it is that we make ourselves aware of that then in turn seems to influence our behavior.
Well, one of the biggest things for me right now is the Venus retrograde, which is in Scorpio. You know, Venus rules our relationships, and the story you shared from the Oz book of the chasm or the chasm and jumping, the lion jumping over that, and how he took all of his friends with him and they bonded through that. You know, the Venus retrograde is a lot about looking around at what's going on and how do we work together to solve it. And it can be, all retrogrades force us to slow down, which in American culture is kind of...
That's verboten.
Just not what we do.
No.
And one of the things I see a lot right now in my practice is people are having these amazing opportunities to really slow down and sort through what they value in their friendships and their relationships and the different incidents and issues in their lives, and kind of revisit what's important and then recommit to those things.
And so we have these various holidays. Halloween is for most of us here in the States is the big one that's fast approaching on the 31st, which happens to be on a Sunday this year. I'm actually going to be out whale watching, assuming there will be any whales out there to watch on the 31st with some friends and my wife and some friends of ours. Regardless, I just love being out on the water. I don't care if a whale goes by or a can of tuna. Preferably not a can of tuna, mind you, but you know what
right.
I mean. And then, of course, we have Thanksgiving, latter part of November. I know that Hanukkah's coming, and Christmas, and, what's the other one? It's like the triple threat in December, and I can't think of the third one that's only been around.
Kwanzaa.
Thank you very much.
And
that's
then the winter solstice.
The solstice. There's number four.
Yeah. It's a time when ancient peoples believed that the walls between the world are the thinnest, and so it's the easiest to access our inner wisdom, the wisdom of the ancestors, the wisdom of the gods, the universal oneness, and if we can slow down and allow ourselves to be comforted and reassured by those things, it makes it easier for us to get along in the world and with each other. And I think these holidays are a large part of that, of focusing.
So in closing, what would you recommend that we be doing at this time to best take advantage of the opportunity?
Right now, I think this time of year, anything that directs your attention inward between now and Thanksgiving is massive. You know, regular prayer and meditation, or putting more time and energy into that. Workshops like the one John has coming up, anything that takes you back to drink from the well of the unconscious is going to be helpful.
Well, wonderful. Well, we will look forward to talking with you in 2 weeks and getting
Alrighty
more information,
then.
Okay?
Alrighty then.
I think 2 weeks, that's the 30th, day before Halloween.
Yes, it is.
We'll be in touch.
Very good. Thanks, guys.
Thank
Have a good day.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
And that is Beth McDonald, I'm never sure whether it's astronomical or
astrological,
but she's my assignment editor, and she's doing a great job, and I really am thankful that she's there.
But, you know, you're correct, because astrology requires a knowledge of astronomy.
Well, and the other thing that has struck me about both sciences, if you will, is that the planets are in constant motion, and I have not been able to figure out yet why it is that the constellations stay in the same basic formations from century to century when the entire universe is not only spinning in total, but even the little parts are spinning, like the cogs in a Swiss watch.
Yeah.
They're all spinning, so they're all changing their positions all the time. So how is it that Orion's belt has maintained its belt-like consistency over the millennium? It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, because if you look into a book called An Ephemeris, which gives you the planet's positions, you can look at one 100 years in the future, and it'll give you the exact positions of Venus, Mars, Mercury, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and it'll be correct.
Yeah. Well, and on top of the fact that people will say, well, but they're not in the same position because they move in the sky. That's not what I'm saying. They move in the sky. I understand that. But they still maintain their Big Dipper look, their Little Dipper look,
yes.
Orion's belt look. They maintain that. There's something. Now, I'm starting to think that it's a giant ceiling that's way out there that's been painted, and somebody just keeps shifting it a little bit every so often, and there are little pinholes through it, and somebody's got a light shining back.
I think what's even more amazing, that is amazing. That I regard as, you know, divinity. That's a miracle.
Yeah.
Of all the books that have come out since 1900, which have had the orientation of understanding more about who we are, and all the great teachers that have come along, and the workshops, and the TV, and the media, and magazine articles. And here we are at 2010, and you look around the world and you go, haven't people been paying any attention?
Yeah. Hello, wake up.
I mean, I do a lot of research, brain research. I'm interested in, and I teach that piece in my classes in adult ed in my new workshops called the Land of Oz workshops. 30 million people in America are taking Xanax or Valium. 30 million.
Oh, man. I have to tell you that based upon the commercials for the pharmaceuticals that I see on TV, I'd rather have the disease that I'm taking the pill for than the side effects for the pill I'm taking for the disease.
Yeah.
Wow. But what's interesting is that it doesn't seem as though we're trying to find out the cause for the need for that pill. We're just treating that symptom, and we're not understanding. Matter of fact, I heard something on the BBC the other day where they're actually starting to make the connection between the modern Western civilization and our ailments, our diseases, our inability to function, our inability to slow down, as Beth was sharing that we need to start, that this period is going to sort of force us to do, and that we're almost, there's a certain level of doomedness to the scenario if we don't find a way. And that's what this program is about, is finding those other ways.
Exactly. So what I've had as an orientation for myself in my classes and workshops that I teach is meditation, imagery work, helping people to slow down, spend more time in nature, learn how to play more. In fact, there's a section in Returning to the Land of Oz about the importance of play. Mm-hmm. I think I will go on maybe about 4 or 5 pages about it, and that it's fundamental to human nature to play. It's how we became social beings through play. We learned about our body. We learned about our psychology.
Yeah.
We learned about how to connect with people through play. And somehow we've gotten away from that. Play is not just going to a gym and working out.
I don't even see that as play. Really don't.
A lot of people, I think, regard it as that. And it's not just, play is just bigger than that. And it's fundamental to human nature, and we need to spend more time with it. So I teach about 6 different approaches to meditation, help people to relax, help people to go inside.
Wow. I have to say that as you speak about play, the mental images are, I see my parents back, because it was their house, it was not mine. I just got to live there. But as a kid.
Did they remind you of that?
Yes, on very rare occasions, but they did. But I was there in the backyard, and my brother and I were sitting in the backyard. The back fence was covered. It was a chain link fence covered with oleanders, which my dad hated because they were getting into the sewer line. But we were in this one area right in this little crescent shape, digging holes. We were taking all this old wood. I don't even remember where it all came from. We were building this fort, putting in nails. Oh, I can't believe how many nails that we stepped on with our bare feet. Never had a tetanus shot until I was 49. Never had a tetanus shot. Never got tetanus either. But just those experiences of just playing and having fun in the dirt and with these raw materials, taking my mother's Indian blankets and making tents in the backyard under the giant pine tree and sleeping out overnight and having the radio on and listening just as atmosphere to Vin Scully calling the Dodger games back in Phoenix because we were getting them then, running around the neighborhood. There were no big fences and concrete walls between the yards, and we would race up and down the blocks and in the alleys, and we were having the best time, and we weren't gangs trying to destroy things. We were playing.
Yeah, and one of the statistics I think was interesting is that 20 years ago, 85% of elementary school children played a sport after school, and now it's down to about 10%.
Oh. Wow. I have to say that we would actually play a game of kickball. And my parents' front yard was the diamond, if you will. And because there were no fences between like 8 or 10 of the yards, but on both sides of the street, and we were lucky because at the end of the street were T-sections. So when a car came around the corner, they were going slow enough to where we had time to stop the game and get out of the way. But it was like an open field. And the worst thing that ever happened was we'd kick the ball into one of the giant palm trees and then have to get another ball. But we had the greatest time. And it was just marvelous.
I think a lot of people like The Wizard of Oz because it's a very playful movie.
And it kind of takes you to your play space, if you will.
Yeah, and it came out towards the end of the Great Depression, 1939. We were still digging out of it. And people loved going to movie houses to kind of
escape,
yeah, be transported to a different place. And so in 1937, you had Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And then in 1939, you had The Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind, and Hunchback of Notre Dame, you know, a bunch of movies. In fact, 1939 is regarded as the golden age of film.
Wow. Wow. Well, that would make sense. And in a way, a lot of people are doing that today. They're feeling the pinch, they're feeling the squeeze, whatever, and they need a place to go to get away. Because if they don't, they may explode. But we really need
implode.
But even back then, they were getting out and doing things. Okay, even if they were going to the movies, after the movies, they would go out and do stuff. But we're not doing that because our technology is keeping us texting and twittering and that respect, but we're not connecting with people.
Yeah.
Because you don't really connect with people in the theater. Not in the same way.
Yeah, I guess people think they're connecting because they call it social media.
Yeah.
But it is an odd way of connecting.
I haven't figured out how it's social. To me, a social gathering is, it's people getting together in the same physical space, if you will, to interact. And it doesn't have to be networking or marketing. It's just, hey, let's get together and sit down over a glass of wine and talk. Let's have a good time. Speaking of having a good time, you have some events that are coming up.
I do. I've got, four, which I would regard as local. Saturday, October 30th at the Schott Center on Bath Street. I'm teaching an all-day course there at 9:30 to 4:30. It's free unless you're a marriage and family therapist, a nurse, or a licensed clinical social worker, then you can come and get CEUs to keep your license up.
Oh, great. Good benefit.
It's a full day of learning how to use imagery in both educational and therapeutic ways.
Okay.
That's going to be in room number 3.
Okay.
That class has already reached its full capacity by people who have registered on the internet.
Ah, okay. That's
but
right.
Yeah. My experience, this is the way it's been every time I've taught that class, people sign up for the class and then they do something else on that day. So even when it tells you on the internet that the class is full. They hold it at 55. Come anyway and you will get a seat.
Yeah.
No problem. And because we can always move into the auditorium.
Absolutely.
Then on November 13th, I'm doing an all-day class from 10 to 4 at Center of the Heart. It's a spiritual center on Turnpike.
Yes.
Used to be the Church of Religious Science there.
Been there.
And it's going to be a class on my book, Returning to the Land of Oz, and how, and the focus is going to be on the mind, imagination, and heart. We're going to be teaching them meditation processes, and we're going to be taking them back to the Land of Oz to unearth all the nuggets of wisdom there. It's going to be a fun day with music and movement.
Very cool.
Then
very cool.
On December 8th, I'm going to be speaking at the International Conference for Positive Aging, which is organized by the Fielding Institute right here on Santa Barbara Street. But it's going to be in Los Angeles. And that is a conference of speakers from all over the world talking about the aging problems, the aging conflicts. And they were looking for creative speakers who have information on newest brain research and creativity and helping us as we're getting older as a society and everyone who's aging, including me, and how to make it a positive experience.
Yeah. Go ahead.
And then I have another gig coming up in either January or February, but it's going to be a fun thing at the it's a hotel right there as you're moving, leaving Carpinteria on the right side. It's called the...
You know
that hotel? It's right on the beach there.
I want to say it's the Hilton, but I don't think that's correct.
No, it's way before
My wife
Ventura.
Would know the name of the hotel there, because I know we stopped there on one journey. We both had our pictures taken there, and I can't remember the name
of
the hotel.
They have a fabulous restaurant there.
Biltmore?
No, it's a private hotel right on the beach. As you anyway, I'm doing an all day workshop there, which will include a fabulous dinner cooked by the hotel. Oh, the Cliff House.
Cliff House. Okay, great.
The Cliff House, and include a marvelous lunch as well. Now, one of the best ways for people to get information about these things is just to email me, and I'll send them flyers on these events.
And the email it is?
Is this? Yeah, they'd have to write this down, but it's J. Tamiazzo, which is TAMIAZZO at charter.net.
Okay.
J. Tamiazzo. And then they email me, and I email them a flyer back.
And I'm curious, if they were to go to a website, your website, and they were to find your email address there?
Well, I have a new website that just came out about 3-4 days ago. It's called... LandOfOzWorkshops.com, LandOfOzWorkshops.com. Right now, they're still working on the Google connection, but if you go through Internet Explorer, it'll take you right there, and it says on there, Returning to the Land of Oz, Dr. John Tamiazzo's blog.
Okay.
And it gives you all the information about the book and about me and the upcoming events.
Then I'll change that link because I have a different website that talks about your imagery, creating applications.
Yeah, that's my old one.
Right.
That's going to be taken down in the next 2-3 months. And
well, then today, before you leave, I will change that so that it's the correct... So
yes.
We send them to the right place.
Yes.
So they can get in touch with you, that you can send them the flyers to participate in some of these wonderful events.
Yes, and I have some articles that they can read there on brain research and things like that.
That, by the way, maybe you can answer a question that has been bothering me for probably 20, 25 years. I interviewed a gentleman back in Phoenix that many years ago. He wrote a book called, I think it was called Brain Power, How to Utilize the Other 90% of Your Brain.
Uh-huh.
So the assumption is that we're only using 10%. And I find that suspicious in that there's something not right about that. Is that still... the case? Is that still the modern, the current thinking that we're still only using 10% of the capacity of our brains?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but what I do know is that what we're eating is not going to maximize our brain power, the food that people typically buy. Santa Barbara is a special place. We've got wonderful restaurants. We've got a lot of organic produce here. It's a very conscious oriented city, but if you look at the rest of America, and the food people eat, like I tell the students in my adult ed class, that probably, and I hope this is no offense to anyone out there who runs Vons or Ralph's, but I tell them probably 75-80% of the food in those large stores are not healthy to eat.
Yeah.
And that aisle that has all the frozen food and ice cream, just forget that aisle. Walk right by that one. That's not going to help you. Also, one of the things I tell people is how to eat food that will feed the brain. That's one of the key pieces of my adult ed class.
Well, and that is important. I was also told of this myth because, and I call it a myth because of what I was also told in regards to the human biology, that the human body, head to toe, front to back, side to side, over the period of roughly 7 years, all the 3 trillion cells, including the brain, all of those cells are changed out over the period of 7 years.
Yes.
And yet I was taught that once a brain cell dies, it's gone. And so you want to be careful, especially with alcohol, because you don't want to kill those brain cells because they will never grow back. And I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. But you're telling me also that the human body regenerates every 7 years.
Yeah.
All the cells, not just certain ones and not the brain.
Yeah, even areas in the brain that have been traumatized through different accidents and things. As I was the executive director of Jody House here in town for 6 years, and all we dealt with were brain injury survivors and their families. But you can help create new pathways over areas that have been damaged if you eat well, if you use meditation processes, relaxation processes, if you use imagery processes. There's not everyone, but there are lots of people who have done it, millions of people who have done it. So the brain is an amazingly resilient organ.
Well, that actually elicits the conversation that I've had with a number of people over this whole issue of cell regeneration, and that I could cut my hand, the back of my hand today, and probably within a week, you'd never notice that it had been cut because the cells regenerated back to a healthy skin. However, and I talk about my left eye, which I have glaucoma in and I don't see out of anymore. Why aren't those cells regenerating back to healthy cells? Why is the skin getting the information to regenerate back to health, but the eye is not? And I think that that is a technology, if you will, and part of science and biology that they're actually delving into nowadays. I know stem cell research is part of that.
Yes.
But why do we need stem cells when we are already regenerating? So how do I tell the eye, I want you to regenerate to healthy cells so I can see out of that eye again?
Yeah, and there's probably people probably right here in this country who have had the same problem, challenge that you have and have had some kind of recovery from it. And why they have and why other people haven't, that's almost like the question of why two people born in the same family with the same parents, one ends up having lots of challenges in life and the other one seems to be doing okay, or you have the case where two people born in the same type of family, maybe it's an abusive family, one becomes a famous playwright and takes all of those challenges and traumas and pours them into something creative, and the other person just has difficulty all through life. One of the stories I tell in Returning to the Land of Oz is about John Muir, who I thought as a little boy, he's our great environmentalist of all time, the patron saint of you know, the American woods, the American wilderness. I thought that his parents probably took him outside and introduced him to the flowers and the plants and you know, the snow and the mountains and the trees, and it wasn't like that. I read the story about him and I was shocked. John Muir was an abused little boy. His mother died early on and his father was a minister and beat him severely on a regular basis with a belt.
Wow.
And so the only place he could get any peace of mind or felt any safety was in nature. And so he would always run into nature and befriend it as Mother Nature, his mother that he had lost. And so he ran away from home, I think, when he was 15 or 16, and he only returned once as his father had changed and he hadn't, so he never came back. But he literally slept outside and embraced Mother Nature. But you think about it, here's a kid beaten up every day and who becomes a great environmentalist, and you take another kid beaten up every day and something else happens with their life, and it's not that. They end up maybe in an institution. And why? Who knows?
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, one of my previous guests, we kind of got into that philosophical discussion of why. It's fascinating because it starts to bring up the issues of, predestination versus free will, and where does one end and the other one begin if the other one even exists, kind of situation. But that's for another program.
Yeah, another question, why would people not want to listen to you and they'll listen to Rush Limbaugh? I mean, what's that about?
I'm not even going there because I don't know. I'm not even going there.
That's another question. You're like, wow, how does that happen?
This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, and we're talking with John Tomiazzo. He is the author of Returning to the Land of Oz.
Available at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. And Barnes & Noble has it on sale for $8.60.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us. We have a few minutes left before we wrap up the program. I'm going to go ahead and skip our last commercial break. Because what I like to do at the end of each of these programs is pose the final question. And we really didn't get into a lot of your background prior to mm-hmm. all of this wonderful education into the master's degree in psychology and teaching at SBCC and all of these, and then, of course, writing the book, Returning to the Land of Oz. You could have done a lot of other things with your life, but you didn't. Why this? Why now?
Well, I love to write. It's my second book. The first book was Love and Be Loved, which came out, like 24 years ago. I love writing. I express myself well in written form, and I love the research. I love playing with sentences. I think the key reason, though, beyond the writing piece, is that in 1939, The Wizard of Oz came out as we were climbing out of the Great Depression. Now we're trying to climb out of the Great Recession. And I thought it was very timely to bring back the same book. Apparently, Andrew Lloyd Webber had the same idea because he's got a new play coming out called The Wizard of Oz. And Michael Crawford, who was the lead singer in The Phantom of the Opera, is going to be The Wizard of Oz.
Oh.
And this is going to be, I think they're going to have the premiere in London, but they're already selling tickets, and I think it's going to be Broadway also. So this is his new project, The Wizard of Oz. And then Robert Downey Jr. is going to play The Wizard of Oz in a new film coming out next year, based upon The Wizard of Oz. So The Wizard of Oz, and I didn't know those two pieces when I wrote this book.
Yeah.
This came to my attention about a month ago. So we're at a time in our development where we're climbing out of a very difficult period, and we're still not out yet.
Yeah.
And when the film came out, 1939, we still hadn't gotten out either. So there's some major piece of information that this story has for us
that helps
us.
Yeah.
Yes.
I would like to see us learn the lessons is what I'd like to see us learn. And so we can move forward and beyond having to do this again. We did it in 39. We're doing it here. Let's not repeat this. Let's learn from it and move forward. John, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, the book is entitled Returning to the Land of Oz. It is finding hope, love, and courage on your yellow brick road. And who knows? Maybe it is paved with gold. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. We come your way every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific Time, and we are archived at richarddugan.com, and I would love to hear from you. Send me an email, richard@richarddugan.com. That's richard@richarddugan.com. Join us again next Saturday at this same time, 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific Time. Until then, love to Lal.